Today on Maine Calling, E.B. White, psalm writer. 125 years ago today, on July 11th, 1899, one of America's most beloved writers was born. Elwin Brooks White, E.B. White, is best known for his children's book, Charlotte's Web, which is set on a Maine farm. In her review of the book for the New York Times in 1952, Eudora Welty wrote, "As a piece of work, it is just about perfect." But for many people, it is E.B. White's essays that endure, especially those about dogs, lakes and camping, and the natural world. Do you have a favorite? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we celebrate E.B. White's birthday with his granddaughter and the author of an illustrated biography of White. What does E.B. White mean to you? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. From Charlotte's Web to the Elements of Style, E.B. White's words have had a widespread influence on generations of readers and writers. And there is so much more to his work than those examples I just gave. Today, E.B. White's birthday, we celebrate his prolific career and learn about his life in Maine. Joining me, Martha White, who is E.B. White's granddaughter and also a writer and editor. She is literary executor of her grandfather's work. And Melissa Sweet, a children's book writer and illustrator and author of Some Writer, The Story of E.B. White. We invite you to join the conversation. Did you happen to know E.B. White? Do you have a favorite quote of his, a favorite essay? Do you have questions for his granddaughter or his biographer? Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us. And Martha, I'm just going to start by saying that I think a lot of people who've read E.B. White essays feel as though they know him or know what he was like. And I'm wondering, I'm going to go to somebody who really did know him very well. What was your grandfather like?
Well, he was a terrific grandfather. I mean, I knew him as my grandfather. And really, it wasn't until I went off to high school that I realized anybody else knew him at all as a writer. I mean, I knew he spent a lot of time in his office working on New Yorker essays and so forth. And we had the children's books, of course. He gave us each the children's books. But we knew him as a grandfather. My brothers and I, we spent a lot of time in his barn. We visited the lambs when they were newborn lambs. We went down to his shore. We helped with the chores and in the gardens, both the vegetable gardens and the flower gardens for my grandmother. So he was quiet. He was unassuming. He was a very private man. People would have considered him shy. I think he was not a public speaker. And he was always kind of an escape artist, whether he was at the New Yorker or at home. When he was home, for instance, and about to turn 70, he asked me if I would drive him to Vermont so he wouldn't be in Brooklyn on his 70th birthday in case people showed up, you know.
He was afraid people would throw him a party?
Or come and want to interview him for the newspaper or something like that, you know, get his age-old wisdom or something. But even at the New Yorker, I mean, he shared an office with James Thurber, and he had a fire escape in his office, and somebody might come, you know, looking for one or the other of them, and he would escape out the fire escape and onto the street, go find something to write about. He did not give public readings. He hated to have to show up on a stage to accept an award. He tried it once or twice without much success, and then decided he didn't need to do it anymore. So he was mostly comfortable, in the barnyard and in a boat on a lake. A lot of his escapes led to either the Belgrade Lakes or the bayous in Florida, or in New York, the reservoirs and, bird watching in Central Park and so forth.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall, James Thurber and your grandfather chatting in the office?
I absolutely would.
Oh my goodness. And before we move on to you, Melissa, I want to ask Martha. I think one of the reasons, and we can talk about this for the entire hour, all the reasons that E.B. White's writing endures, but one of the reasons is because it's witty and warm. And I'm wondering, Martha, was he witty and funny in person, or was that something he kind of saved for his writing?
No, he was. I don't think he tried to be. He wasn't a natural storyteller. He wasn't a grandfather who you could say, "Tell me a story," and he would make it up on the spot. And he wasn't somebody who would go into a, I mean, if he went into a evening gathering at all, he wasn't somebody who would be, the star of the show. He wouldn't be the gregarious one in the center of a crowd telling the story. But when he was comfortable, if it was people he was comfortable with, or certainly with children, he could be very funny and witty in a kind of Maine way, very dry humor, the occasional comment, the observation that was very precisely worded. That would make you laugh. And he particularly was very respectful of young children and very observant of young children. And so he could very quickly make a friend with any young person and have a rapport with them as if he'd known them for a long time.
Melissa, I'm going to turn to you. You wrote a biography and illustrated a biography of E.B. White, and I understand to do that, you read and looked at photo albums and you got your hand on every possible thing you possibly could. And I'm wondering, if you could take yourself back in time to before you launched the project and sort of what got you started, and were there any surprises in researching and writing about E.B. White?
Sure. I had been illustrating books for a very long time and began to illustrate picture book biographies for younger readers. And at that time, I had written a couple of books and loved the process of doing the research and not only illustrating the book, but writing and combining those words and images. So I had lightning strike one day in Rockport, Maine. I was walking my dog. And I thought, oh, I want to write another biography, but who could I do it on? And I thought, oh, if I could do a biography on anybody, it would be E.B. White. He was some writer. And it was bang. I just got in my car with the dog, drove home, pulled Letters of E.B. White off my shelf, and I was going with it. And the premise was that because I loved Charlotte's Web and I felt that the way he wrote was so clear and lyrical and witty that what if there was a biography that not only told his story, but that there was a lot of his words in it? So poems and essays and just pieces from letters that would be an amalgamation of my words and images and his words, that it would be a whole nother generation of people learning about him, not just from his children's books. So it was a dream project. And as you said, I looked at scrapbooks and home movies. And that was because Martha and I met up. I was pretty far into the book, to be honest with you, but nothing could stop me from doing the research and writing. And then it dawned on me that I would need permissions. So Martha and I connected, and that's how she arrived one morning at my studio with this paraphernalia that just was, I felt like a diamond had dropped on my lap. So an uncut diamond, I should say. So I'm really grateful to them, but it wouldn't be the book it is without all of E.B. White's words.
Well, let me interject a little bit here. So when I came into Melissa's studio the first time to hear about this project, we had already turned down two or three people who wanted to write biographies of E.B. White, and I thought, "Uh-oh, this is not going to be good," because I knew Melissa a little bit. We both were dog walkers, but I didn't know. I mean, I knew some of her children's books, but I didn't know your other biographies, and so I did not come fully prepared with lots of information the first time. I came ready to sort of do a look and see. And what I remember was that you were about 2 years into the project at that point, and you had a huge, a really draft book put together with all the possible things you might put in it. And I remember early on, first, your studio was amazing. If anybody ever has seen Melissa's studios, they're quite wonderful to visit. But also, Melissa, by that time, knew almost as much about my grandfather as I did. And that's saying something, because by then I had been, you know, curating my grandfather's works for probably 15 or 20 years. So I'd read everything. And so had she. She had really done her homework and had kind of a outline or sketch of what the book was going to look like. And I was immediately there with the project as soon as I saw that. I just knew, here's the one we're going to say yes to. And then we started sharing the trove of photographs and all sorts of items, the little model of Flounder and the scow that he built on the shore called Flounder, which Melissa and her husband then built their own version of.
Oh, my if goodness.
If you look at Melissa's author photo in the book, I think it's in that scow. Am I right?
Exactly. It is. It is. Martha had kindly brought over this book E.B. White has had as a boy called the Boy's Handbook. No, there's
the American Boy's Handbook. Yeah,
the American Boy's Handbook, and in it there were boat building plans, and that's where my husband got the plans for the scow to make it identical. So we were living and breathing E.B. White for many years, but it was kind of a gift.
Right,
not
right.
Kind of. It was a lot of fun.
That scow, by the way, my grandfather had taken the American Boy's Handbook and built that scow for my father when my father was 10. So that was Flounder. And then my father, likewise, did the same for his younger son, John, my brother, when he was about the same age, and we had another scow, the Sea Dragon, I think she was called, on our pond. And then Melissa built one.
You know, Martha, I have to say, I love the name Flounder for a small vessel, but it's so literary because it has so many meanings, right?
Yeah, no, it's a flat bottom boat.
Oh, that's great. Well, Melissa, you know, your book is called Some Writer, which is obviously a take on Some Pig from Charlotte's Web. So many people love Charlotte's Web. It's been described as the perfect book by Eudora Welty, or near perfect. And I'm wondering, what is it, if you, as a children's book author, would like to say, what is it about Charlotte's Web that makes it so almost perfect?
He had the idea to write another children's book after Stuart Little. And sometime after that, he had a pig that died. And the genesis of that idea came from wanting to write a story about saving a pig's life. So he just kind of put that in the back of his pocket. But not long later, he saw a spider spinning a web and laying an egg sac. And he stopped to look at it, and in E.B. White's style, he was mesmerized by this small moment in nature. And he took the egg sac and kept it with him, and soon after, all these little spiders came out. But then he said to himself, what if a spider could save a pig's life? And what I love about it is it's all from his life and just meandering around the farm. The characters are from his farm, Templeton the rat, the pig, the geese, etc. And when he began to write it, those characters took front and center. Those were the main characters. But White is a consummate editor. He wrote the story and would go over it and over it. And I can give you an example of the first lines. He was never satisfied. He had started with the farmer. He starts with the pig. He starts with Charlotte. None of it was gelling, so he did a few iterations. And to his credit, he set the whole book aside for a while. Maybe it was 5 years to 5 months to a year, I think, that he set it aside. And he came back and he added Fern. So he had this idea, but he also let the story dictate that it was working well or it wasn't. So once he brought Fern in and Fern became one of the main characters, he started the book with, "Where's Papa going with that axe?" said Fern to her mother as they were setting the table for breakfast. And it was alarming, really, to me to see how pastoral it was in the beginning. And then he shoots to the chase. And you can just imagine him, somebody walked, a farmer walking out of the kitchen with an axe and his daughter wondering where he's going. So that kind of immediacy is all throughout the book. Plus, the idea of life and death on a farm is just a reality, and it's a reality in nature. The first few pages, especially the first page of Charlotte's Web, it's kind of all there. Not even kind of, it's all there. A pig is born and a pig is about to die. And there's the heroes start to unravel. So Fern is a hero because she saves the pig, but we later learn Charlotte saves Wilbur, and Templeton is a hero because he gets the words for Charlotte. So I feel like he took the barn as a community. Sometimes it worked together and sometimes it didn't, but they all gave something and they all got something back. I mean, that's very much a synopsis, but every page is kind of pointing to the same theme. And I think it was in the crafting of that. Would you say that, Martha, that it was in the crafting of the book it unfolded?
Yes, absolutely. I mean that the story about how Fern wasn't initially in the book and then later came in because she was needed, I think just right. And one of the things I would say Fern added to the book, besides the first line, "Where's Papa going with that axe?" is if you've ever known a young, I mean, my granddaughter right now is 9 and has chickens and so forth, and the sense of justice and injustice
That's
is big
right.
with young children, and especially on a farm. I mean, as Melissa said, my grandfather had already just experienced the irony of raising a pig for meat, and then having to try to save a pig who is sick, and which puts you in a real conundrum as a farmer. And for Fern, that injustice, the idea that poor Wilbur might be sacrificed, was just too much. And I think children identify with that. I think adults identify with that those sort of larger themes that override the story. I mean, certainly the friendship piece and the community piece, as Melissa said, are big. And I think often the line that people refer to so often that they remember from the book is the one about Charlotte. She I'm going to flub it now. She was a good help me, Melissa. She was a good writer and a good friend. Do you remember how it
Oh,
goes?
it is not often that someone comes along who is a true friend and a good writer. Charlotte was both.
Thank you.
Like the best ending of a story there could ever be. Yeah.
Yeah, and
Well, on
that
that
really.
note, we have to go to a break. We are talking about E.B. White on what would have been his 125th birthday. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning about one of Maine's best-known and admired writers, E.B. White, the impact of his work, and what he was like as a person. He was born on this day in 1899. My guest today, Melissa Sweet. She is a children's book writer and illustrator, and her book, Some Writer, was a biography of E.B. White. Also with us, Martha White, who is the granddaughter of E.B. White and also his literary executor. She herself is a writer and editor. Share your comments and questions ask a question of Martha, who knew her grandfather well, or talk about an essay that means something to you, take part in our show by sending a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And speaking of callers, we'll go to Jordan, who is calling from Dover, New Hampshire. Hi, Jordan. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. I just wanted to, I hope I don't cry, because E.B. White means so much to my family. And I just wanted to share a poem that my husband and I memorized that I believe he wrote for his wife, Catherine, when they were courting. And it goes, "A spider dropping down from twig unfolds a web of her devising, a thin premeditated rig to use in rising. And all that journey down through space in cool descent and loyal-hearted, she builds a ladder to the place from where she started. Thus I gone forth like spiders do, in spiders' webs a truth discerning, attach one silken strand to you for my returning."
Jordan, that's beautiful. And Martha, was it indeed for your grandmother?
Yes, it was written for Catherine. It was actually written shortly after they married in 1929, I think it was. They'd had a fairly rocky courtship, and kind of in the front of everybody at the New Yorker offices, because she was already a experienced editor at the New Yorker when he came on. In fact, she hired him on, and she was older and had two children from her first marriage. So it was at the time kind of a daring thing that they were dating at all. And they both had their misgivings and doubts, but finally just decided to do it, to elope. They went off and got married. And her comment at the time was, if it only lasted a year, it would be worth it. And it lasted some, I don't know, 40 years or something like that, until she died. But Natural History is a terrific poem, and one, of course, people look at often because of the spider metaphor in it. And he certainly was always coming and going. I mean, the year after they married, she was pregnant with my father, you know, 6 months or so after they married, and he went off to Ontario to the summer camp where he was used to working, and did his stint at the camp, you know, while she was still working at the New Yorker, and had two teenagers or near teens coming home for the summer with her, partly, and of course pregnant. So she was used to his coming in and going, and I think it was partly a reassurance to her that he would go away, but he would also always return. And he certainly did return to her. She was kind of an anchor for him always. It's a poem that we treasure in the family. It was in the memorial service booklet for, when he died. That was the poem that we chose. Yeah.
Oh, Jordan, thank you so much for calling and bringing that up. Calling in now is Tori Delisle. She's former director of development for Skedomfa Library in Damariscotta, and she is here to tell us about a book of E.B. White's letters. Thanks for calling in, Tori.
Yes, hello, Jennifer. Thank you for having me. And hello, Martha. It's been a while, but it's nice to hear your voice. Yes, I was the director of development when we uncovered a box of unbeforeseen letters, and they became a book.
So tell us about these letters. They were with Edmund Ware Smith, a friend of his, and what did you learn from them? What did they reveal?
Yes, so it's really quite interesting. The letters span several decades, and when they first start writing to each other, Edmund Ware Smith was actually also a phenomenal author, and possibly, when the correspondence started, perhaps the better known author in his day. And so they start writing to each other first on sort of like a professional level, and then as it sort of turns out that they have so many interests in common, and they have both have a strong Maine connection, though neither of them are originally from there. The friendship just blossoms, and of course, with them both being letters or authors, the letters are hilarious and really heartwarming. And also, you know, there are points of, you know, they also talk about sort of the tragic things that are happening in their lives, and it's just this really heartwarming exchange, and you see their friendship blossom And it was irresistible, when we discovered them, to not think about putting them out there so that more people could enjoy it.
And the book is called Chickens, Gin, and a Maine Friendship?
That is correct. Yep.
Well, Tori, thank you so much for calling in. Tori DeLisle, formerly with Skidamfa Library, who was involved in compiling the book Chickens, Gin, and a Maine Friendship. Melissa, I think just a minute ago you wanted to jump in, and you caught my eye too late. What was it you wanted to say?
Well, I loved hearing that poem, Natural History, again, and I was just going to say that I either read or Martha and I talked about that White thought of himself as a poet to some degree. Do you agree with that, Martha?
He aspired. I don't think he ever dared really call himself a poet. I think he felt untrained and unqualified, although he wrote many, many poems. His first books were poems collections, and some of his poems are just wonderful, and they have a lot of humor to them, as well as a lot of history and a lot of sentiment. He wrote many love poems to my grandmother, not just that one. I think that was what he loved to do. It was a kind of a mind puzzle with words that was perfect for him. I would say he mostly certainly made his living with the essays and the children's books more than the poems, which is probably true of many poets, just because of the culture we live in. But it certainly was, I think, a favorite pastime for him. And I would say he was very good at it.
I've asked our audience if they have favorite quotes, and Susan has responded. This is an email. Susan writes, "This is one of my favorite quotations by E.B. White." And I'm going to interrupt by saying, and I think this is an example of his wit. "I arise each day with an urge to improve the world and an urge to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." And so apparently Susan heard that from Garrison Keillor quoting it. And so I love that. And, talk about understated. This makes it hard to plan the day.
Right. That's also one of the most misquoted quotes, but I think you got it right in that instance. There are many versions of it that have swear words in them, for instance, and I always know it's not an E.B. White quote if it has a swear word in it, because he didn't do that.
Oh, that's great. We're going to go to Linda, who's calling from Oakland. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Linda. This is Linda Kemiston, and I'm just calling to say hello to Martha, because I knew you when we were in Northfield.
Yes.
And we had to read Elements of Style and as a groundwork for all of our books, all of our writing and English classes, which stuck with me all through college and through my career. So I just wanted to say I enjoy hearing about you and what's coming up, and I've always enjoyed your grandfather's books, especially the children's books. So good to hear you. Thank you.
I think, Linda, weren't you a dorm like proctor or something in our dorm?
I was a student, a freshman student officer or cop, and yes. I was and it was like a student proctor in Harry Potter, if you think about the prefix.
Yes,
kind of the
yes.
same idea.
Yeah.
Well, yep. Linda, thank yep. you so much for your call. And you know, Linda has brought up the Elements of Style. And Melissa, I want to ask you as an author, and Martha, you are as well, but the influence of E.B. White's writing style on American literature. I mean, there is an American voice that I don't know. Is it possible to overstate his influence on how writers write?
There are countless people who have Strunk and White's Elements of Style. And Professor Strunk was who, correct me on this, Martha, he wrote the book and then E.B. White went back and edited it later, correct? After many, many years. So then it became Strunk and White.
Strunk was a Cornell professor of my grandfather's, and he had what he called the little book. And it was this book of rules that became Strunk and White's Elements of Style. My grandfather wrote a profile of Strunk, I think after he died, for the New Yorker. And Macmillan asked my grandfather if he would put the book together with some editing and additional material. And that became the Strunk and White Elements of Style that's in so many high school and college, you know, classrooms today. Yeah.
But many people
wondering the use of everyday language, unpretentious, warmth, short sentences, the influence on just simple.
Omit needless words. Omit needless words. It was a phrase that struck repeated three times in the classrooms. Omit needless words. Omit needless words. Omit needless words. Meaning, you know, once you write the first draft, go back and take half the words out, as many as you can. Tighten it up. Get the right word. Make it specific. Those kinds of things.
What's appealing about that? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, Melissa, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead, Jennifer. I'll get back to you. Just a second. Go ahead.
One thing
I would add is when I went off to high school, I had my copy of The Elements of Style with me, and it was given to me before I went away to school. And my grandfather wrote in the front of it, sort of a note to me. And then he finished the phrase with, "And you can use all the needless words you want to," which I over time realized it ends in a preposition. And he was basically saying to me, learn the rules and then learn where you can break them. And, you know, use all the unnecessary words you want to.
Well, I think it starts and ends in a preposition, right? And use all the unnecessary words you want to. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I have two emails about Stuart Little, so I'm going to read them both. From Allison, please mention that at least one reader can call up whole scenes from Stuart Little. For instance, the scene in which Stuart is lost in the apartment. I can still hear my father's voice in my memory as he calls softly, "Stuart, Stuart." He was reading the book aloud to me and my siblings more than six decades ago. If that isn't resonance, I don't know what is. I also love Elements of Style. The book never goes out of style for me. It is delightful wisdom for everyone who loves to write. And then from Ed, an email. I love the writing of E.B. White. I think he is the best writer of the 20th century period. My favorite book of his, of children's books, is Stuart Little. I tell my painting students at the University of Maine that it is my favorite book of all time. I've read it to my own children countless times. Absolutely amazing book. One issue with my students, though, is that they only know the Stuart Little movie, laugh out loud. I also love his short stories as well and have read them to my students many times. So, Melissa, I'm going to toss to you. So many people talk about Charlotte's Web, but Stuart Little stands on its own pretty darn well as well.
Stuart Little does stand on its own. And that was a series of short pieces, or maybe we could say essays, that he wrote to tell his nieces and nephews. As the youngest child, he had a lot of nieces and nephews, but that became a book. And in it, I'll link it to Strunk and White, because one of the most beautiful parts of this book to me, even though in Strunk and White they say omit needless words and short sentences, Stuart Little has passages that just are a large paragraph long sentence. And they are the most beautiful, it's the most beautiful imagery. I remember Stu Kestenbaum read aloud a passage from Stuart Little one day, and I just had to stop my car and listen to it again. So I think, I think the beauty of it is that he wasn't trying to write a children's book. He was writing these impressions of this mouse. And yeah, I understand why it's lasted so long.
We are talking about E.B. White. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you might be able to join the conversation, talk@mainecalling.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. What do you want to know about E.B. White? What is important to you about his work? Joining us for this conversation, E.B. White's granddaughter, Martha White, an author and editor, and Melissa White, who's a children's book author and illustrator who wrote about White's life. If you're quick, you might be able to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Rusty. For me, a parent, grandparent, and retired school librarian, I appreciate boundlessly the shared vocabulary E.B. White presented us, a vocabulary of names such as Wilbur and Charlotte, and concepts such as kindness, empathy, humor, friendship, and loss. I am grateful that that vocabulary, as it were, is passed down seamlessly through sharing White's enduring stories. So, Melissa, we were talking earlier about what it is that makes E.B. White still so important to people today. And I kind of think Rusty might have hit the nail on the head.
Definitely Rusty hit the nail on the head. That's beautiful. Exactly. And those themes and the way he crafted them, they're just, it's timeless. People often say his writing is ageless and timeless, and open any book by White and he proves it true.
From Emily here, I'm an adult education teacher and I use the essay Death of a Pig in my college preparation English class every semester. I introduce it as Charlotte's Web for adults. Some students understand this and others, perhaps from other cultures who haven't read Charlotte's Web, need that reference described to them. I read most of the essay aloud in class and let the students continue alone and later reflect in homework assignments. I love to witness the students' dawning and connection to universal themes and values in the human experience. Irony, empathy, humor, mortality, and of course the joys of reading, the impact of reading aloud with tone, and the beauty and the emotions that language can paint in the hands of a master. It's so interesting to me, Martha, that you said that your grandfather wasn't the kind of grandfather that launched into storytelling, because so many people, as grandparents, have been able to read his books aloud, you know, so effectively because of the way he wrote them.
Right. Well, Melissa mentioned it about Stuart Little, that when his nieces would ask him to tell them a story, he really couldn't do that. He couldn't do it off the cuff. So he wrote chapters of Stuart Little as stories that he could pull out of his desk and tell or read to his nieces, because he couldn't do that. And that was kind of the origins of Stuart Little, that and the fact that he dreamt about a mouse when he was on a train one time. But it's true.
I'm going to go to Lee, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hi there. I grew up hearing all of E.B. White's books. Sorry, my dog is barking at the neighbor in the background. And, you know, when I was in elementary school, they were assigned to us to read. I have read them to my children. I have to say, though, my daughter and I are really... We listen to a lot of audiobooks, and the first time that I heard E.B. White read, for me it was particularly The Trumpet of the Swan. It was this whole new experience of the book for me, to hear it in his voice, in his cadence, and so I really recommend to people to seek out the audiobooks where it's his voice reading his work.
Lee, that's so funny that you are calling with that topic, because I have an email here from the children's book author, Chris Van Dusen, and he says, several years ago, I was awarded E.B. White Read Aloud Award for my third book, If I Built a Car. I don't mention this to blow my own horn, but to describe the funny reaction I received from Martha. When I called Martha to tell her about the award, she told me the one thing her grandfather hated was to read aloud, something the Association of Booksellers for Children obviously didn't know about. So, Martha, what do you think it took to get him to read Trumpet of the Swan aloud for an audiobook?
Oh, he didn't mind doing that. He actually read each of his books, but because that was in the solitude, actually, of our own living room.
I see. It was for other people in public. I see.
It wasn't in front of an audience. He didn't like being put on the spot. He loved having other people read children's books. He just didn't want to have to be the one in the hot seat himself in front of an audience. My grandmother was the one who read to us, not my grandfather.
I remember that.
With Chris Van Dusen.
That's great. Well, Lee, thank you so much for calling in. Melissa, we have so many calls coming in, but we can't talk about children's books without asking you what you've got coming up.
Yes, I have a few great books on my plate, and one of them is a poem that E.B. White wrote for The New Yorker. Can I say the title, Martha?
Sure.
It's The Duck Cannot Sleep, and it's about, I feel like it's somewhat autobiographical, this poem, but it takes place in New York City, and this, in the middle of the night, somebody is kind of interacting, having a connection with a duck who also cannot sleep. But I had the great good pleasure of going to New York, spending some time and scouting out Central Park for the correct place, and found a great reservoir. And so everything's underway. That should be out in 2025.
Wonderful, wonderful. Congratulations, Melissa. Martha, something popped into my mind during the last call. We heard her dog barking in the background. We have not mentioned E.B. White's love of dogs, and he's probably up there somewhere laughing at the fact that the dog was calling. It was taking part in Maine Calling today.
I was going to say when the caller called in about the death of the pig, that's a great essay to be introduced to Fred, who was his favorite all-time dachshund and is in many of the essays and stories there. Or you can find Fred all over the essays in E.B. White on Dogs that I put together a few years ago. He is a terrific character in many of the E.B. White stories. And absolutely, E.B. White would never be without a dog. They had many, many, mostly small dogs, most of them rescues of one kind or another, dachshunds and terriers and all kinds of things. They were a big part of our growing up at the farm. The dogs were always there, and most of them neurotic and had big characters to go along with them. He would have loved that.
We're going to go to Deb, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
Hi there. So this is a great program, and I just want to thank your guests for being there, and happy birthday to Evie. So, and all the books that have been mentioned so far are fantastic. I want to suggest to your listeners, there is a wonderful poem that he wrote for the New Yorker in 1945 called The Song of the Queen Bee. And apparently stimulation or the reason that he wrote this poem, which is quoted at the beginning of the poem, it goes, the breeding of the queen bee, says the United States Department of Agriculture Bulletin on Artificial Insemination, has always been handicapped by the fact that the queen mates in the air with whatever drone she encounters. So E.B. took this rather dry entry from United States Department of Agriculture Bulletin and turned it into a wonderful, rollicking poem, which has just fantastic meter and rhyme. It's quintessential E.B. White, in my view. Lots of humor, et cetera. And so you need your, I'm going to suggest to your, both your guests probably know about this poem, but your readers probably don't. Again, it's called The Song of the Queen Bee. And I was particularly taken by this because my full name is Deborah, and Deborah means bee in Hebrew. And I have managed to memorize most of this poem. It's all that long, but it's fantastic.
Well, thank you for that recommendation. Yeah, Martha's smiling as you talk.
My father, years ago, put together a series of audio recordings for River Music called White on White. And it was my father reading his father's poems and essays. And my father chose favorites from the family's list, and that was one of them. And my father reads it beautifully. It's a favorite for sure. A wonderful poem.
Thank you, Deb, for calling in. We will go to Tree calling from Union. Hi, Tree. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a short but very relevant quote for me today from E.B. White. It says, "I am still encouraged to go on. I wouldn't know where else to go."
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that very much, Tree, calling from Union. Tom on Facebook writes, "For every newspaper columnist post-1950, E.B. White set the bar and set it high. One man's meat is required reading for any would-be columnist." And Tom, thanks for saying that. But Melissa, I'm thinking that that might be intimidating. One might not start out on a career if they're trying to write like E.B. White.
Well, true, there's one E.B. White, but he did have a lot of interesting things to say about him as a writer, himself as a writer, because he always said he wrote for an audience of one. He wrote for himself, and I think that advice is just brilliant it allows us room to just be who we are as writers, and have whatever unique voice from us coming forth. And it's incredibly intimidating to work on a book by E.B. White, but I also knew I am not E.B. White, so it could be something else. And the beauty is we can read him ad infinitum. So I appreciate that quote, that sentiment.
An email here from Andrea. I have treasured Scott Elledge's biography of E.B. White since 1985. What is your opinion of this work? Martha, do you have an opinion of that biography?
Yeah, it's a terrific biography. It was helped tremendously along the way by the fact that my grandfather got to be there along the way. Scott Elledge spent about 16 years writing it, and there's a vast correspondence between the two of them. And my grandfather didn't, you know, edit it. He didn't go in and change things that he didn't like having be there. He promised not to do that. But he did help Elledge get things correct. And he was quite candid with him. It allowed him access to virtually everything. And it's beautifully done. There's hardly a wrong word in it. And the correspondence, some of which is in the revised letters book, is funny and fascinating.
We'll go to Bill calling from South Brooksville. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a little anecdote. George and Georgine Allen owned the farm across the street from the Whites, and they were good friends. And when their daughter Kathy was about 7 years old, Georgine gave her a copy of Charlotte's Web that, in fact, had been autographed by E.B. White. Kathy immediately took it, scratched out E.B. White, wrote her own name in it, and said, "This is my book." Of course, Georgine went back over to E.B., and he gave her a brand new signed copy, and they explained to her why it was important that she had a book with his autograph in it.
That's a fun story, Bill. Thank you for sharing.
She was a classmate of mine in school, and I did a similar thing with a book that I had. My grandfather gave me, I think it was the Stuart Little book, and he put the year in it that he gave it to me, which I think was 1962. I would have been eight or something. And I scratched out 1962 and I wrote, "That's the year he gave it to me," meaning that it wasn't the year he wrote it.
That's funny. This is wonderful. This is an email from Lori. I have fond memories of our class trooping into the school library in St. Pete, Florida, sitting cross-legged on the floor in a semicircle while the librarian read Charlotte's Web to us, pausing to show us the illustrations. It wasn't until I reread the book many years later that I realized what I love most about E.B.'s writing. He never wrote down to his audience. I can't think of an example at the moment from Charlotte's Web or Stuart Little, another favorite. I was so taken with the idea of a mouse rolling a dime along the road for bus fare. I never could have imagined I would one day live in his neck of the woods. And so, Melissa, this is very tricky, especially for children's books, isn't it, to not write down to your audience?
That truer words were never spoken. And he said that those words aloud, that he didn't write down to children. He wrote up, that they can handle it a lot of themes and a lot of words. And I think that's also part of his genius. He just wrote. Other authors, Maurice Sendak talks about that they just wrote and somebody decided it was for kids. But I think E.B. White, it's just accessible and kids understand that. Adults and kids, I mean, are such fans of Charlotte's Web and all his children's books.
An email from Greg. There's something about the North, he said, something that sets it apart from all other directions. A person who is heading north is not making any mistake, in my opinion. That's the way I look at it, said Stuart. I rather expect that from now on I shall be traveling north until the end of my days. Greg says, thanks for reminding me of this quote. Heading north has always suited me well. And Martha, we just have a few seconds left, but it has to be stated how much your grandfather loved the state of Maine.
Yes, yes. He preferred Maine, I think, to almost anywhere else. Even in hay fever season, he had terrible hay fever when the rhododendron came out, but he would come anyway in the midst of haying and so forth. He was definitely happiest in the country and in the barn and on the lakes and, you know, in a canoe.
Well, thank you both so much. That was Martha White, editor and writer, and E.B. White's granddaughter, Melissa Sweet, children's book author and illustrator, whose book about E.B. White is called Some Writer. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find any past show or sign up for Maine Calling's weekly newsletter at mainecalling.org. And you can always leave a message for Maine Calling on the Maine Public Vox Pop app. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.